I'm Miles Helfand, and this is HIV Management in Depth at thebodypro.com. It's become increasingly clear over the past few years that the long and winding road to an HIV cure will consist of many pathways. Although substantial research resources are being put toward a renewed push to finally find a viable HIV vaccine, explorations are also expanding into the possible value of other areas, such as gene therapy, stem cell transplantation, even broad-spectrum antivirals. But alongside all of these potential paths to a cure lay the one we've already been on for more than two decades, the use of antiretroviral agents. Despite all we've learned about HIV pathogenesis and treatment, we still don't fully understand either the ultimate potential or the final limits of what antiretroviral therapy can achieve. And given that effective HIV treatment remains, for the moment at least, the closest alternative we have to a widely available cure, it's justly still receiving a great amount of attention for some of our brightest research minds. Which is where our interviewee for this episode of HIV Management in Depth comes in. Jonathan Lee is an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School's Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's a highly respected HIV research veteran, and he has teamed up with his equally respected Brigham colleague, Paul Sachs, to conduct a new study. Its focus is on the effect of single-pill, once-daily antiretroviral therapy on HIV-positive people who, until recently, we didn't think needed to be on treatment at all. I'm talking, of course, about HIV controllers. But why don't I let Dr. Lee explain it? We spoke by phone earlier this month to discuss the details of his new endeavor, an AIDS clinical trials group study known as A5308. So why don't we start with a little bit of background leading into why this study exists?
HIV controllers, as you are well aware, is this really remarkable group of patients who can suppress their HIV virus to very low levels without the need for antiretroviral therapy. Now, historically, it's been thought that these patients are in a privileged position and at little risk of HIV disease progression or clinical disease. Mm-hmm. But it's become clearer over the past couple years that this assumption is just not entirely true. And we found that HIV controllers generally have active viral replication, just very low levels of it. And they have higher levels of chronic inflammation, which we're concerned may lead to increased risk of early aging and HIV disease progression, especially since a subset of patients do have eventual kind of CD4 decline over time. And there's been some recent studies showing that HIV controllers may have higher cardiovascular disease as well. And so the primary goals of this study is to determine whether antiretroviral treatment can lower inflammation and kind of normalize the immune function for the HIV controllers.
The last time that I was tuned into prevalence numbers, we're talking low percentages of people who are identified as HIV controllers. So we're talking a small group of people that you can possibly pluck from, right? What's the percentage estimated of people living with HIV who are controllers?
It's tough. Those who individuals with viral loads less than 50 copies, it's far less than 1%. With controllers, we're looking at viral load less than 500, probably still less than 5%, I would say.
What kind of research has been done so far in this area, by which I mean the potential effects of initiating antiretroviral therapy on people who are controllers and the additional benefits that may come from that?
Absolutely. So there's been one small study
that's
been published. Pretty much.
Okay.
This was published just last year by Steve Deek's group and Hiroyu Hatano. You probably know them from UCSF, maybe, potentially. But they published a study of 16 participants. And interestingly, they found that treating HIV control, and they had a slightly different definition. They used, I think, viral load less than 1,000 in their study, so a little bit of a looser term for HIV controllers. But they found that it decreased HIV viral load. Even at the very low levels, they could see a decrease. And also, there appears to be a decrease in markers of T cell activation. Now, that study, as I mentioned, is a smaller pilot study, 16 participants. They didn't have the sample size to really fully explore some of the important effects that they found. They found, for example, trends in various other markers, soluble inflammatory markers that they just didn't have the sample size for. And in addition, our study has a viral dynamics component where we're kind of intensively studying how the virus decays with the use of antiretroviral therapy. And that'll give us some insight on the various reservoirs that are harboring HIV and really has a can give us a better insight on where HIV might be hiding in these patients. So there are some differences. I think that was a smaller pilot study that we're trying to build off of as well. The upside of also having that study is that it reassures us on a couple of different fronts. First, that being treated with antiretroviral therapy, there is risk of various of side effects, right? But this study, as well as some of the participants that we've enrolled so far, have generally found it to be very well tolerated, the antiretroviral therapy. And in addition, a second concern that we've, you know, a kind of a hypothetical concern that we've had when designing the study, is the fact that when patients are put on therapy, generally because their immune system is, how do I put it, less revved up. It's not as activated all the time, right? As when they see kind of active viral replication, that what happens when these patients stop therapy? Can their immune system still control the virus? And in Steve's study, they had a number of patients who stopped therapy and they went back to kind of return to their controller status, which to us is also reassuring as well.
Do you guys have a hypothesis going in that you figure Complera is going to have exactly the same benefit? Is there anything in particular you're expecting?
Yeah, so one of the reasons we chose Complera is that it's better tolerated than efavirenz, which is the most commonly used antiretroviral therapy today, the H-tripla, right? Yep. The efavirenz-based or containing regimens. But rilpivirine has been shown to be better tolerated. Now, in the head-to-head trial against efavirenz, rilpivirine did worse really in the group of patients with the highest viral load. So those patients with viral load over 100,000. And these patients are the exact opposite of that. These are patients with the lowest viral loads. And so those patients did really well in that study. And so we do think that is the reason why, one of the reasons why Complera was chosen. But we do believe, I mean, our hypothesis is that antiretroviral therapy will decrease not just kind of T cell inflammation, but also a lot of these soluble markers of inflammation that you've been hearing about that have been linked to various other chronic long-term effects of aging and non-AIDS spotting conditions, you know, like cardiovascular disease, cognitive dysfunction, and things like that. Now, I think that another important point is that I think that this is I've been kind of asked, like, what does this mean for kind of the cure agenda? Mm. HIV controllers have always thought to be an ideal, kind of a natural model for what a successful functional cure would resemble. You know, if you can get someone who is not a controller to a controller status by stimulating their immune system or somehow, you know, giving them some therapeutic vaccine, then that would be as good as a cure. But if this is really our goal, then I think that we have to have a complete understanding of what it means for our patients, right? Will further suppression of this already low-level viral load have any additional benefits for our patients, for this population, and for our patients in the future, right? What is the cost of not achieving complete suppression of the virus?
And by complete, in this case, you're talking about what, sub 10, sub 5?
Well,
sub...
you know that's you can't give a number to it because even when patients are on a fully suppressive antiretroviral therapy regimen, right, they're 100% adherent, you can still find some HIV in their bloodstream. How much HIV is in there will depend on how long they've been on treatment and probably depend on kind of the size of their viral reservoir, things like that. But that HIV is not likely to be causing new rounds of replication. Some of that is just some HIV that will come out because they've got this reservoir where HIV is constantly kind of being produced, right? Yeah. But HIV controllers, all elite controllers and controllers, will have higher levels, right? I can't say exactly. It's hard to kind of quantify the difference, but there's definitely, it's been shown that HIV, even elite controllers, kind of have these detectable viremia episodes, and controllers have even higher viral loads than that. And these are definitely higher viral loads than what you would normally see, I think, in patients on long-term suppressive antiretroviral therapy. And the question is, does getting them from an already low level to an even, you know, to fully suppressing them to an even lower level, how much does that help? And do we think that that amount of benefit in terms of inflammation is enough to kind of affect any downstream, you know, long-term health of these patients? And also, I think a lot of the immunology and the virology components of this study will give us kind of a lot of important insight on the pathogenesis of HIV within this population, and really give us a deeper understanding of where HIV is hiding and how the immune system maintains control. When we're studying elite controllers, and we say, okay, so elite controllers have, or controllers have some amounts of viral replication, and we know that controllers have higher amounts of chronic inflammation. Well, are these two related, right? If you don't treat, you can never really 100% tell how much these things are related, and or whether they are two completely different processes. So those are some of the reasoning behind doing some of this study. In addition to just helping the patients themselves.
What kind of other sub-analyses are you guys planning? Like, are you guys planning to look into specific, I mean, as much as it's realistic or possible to do, specific tissues or compartments?
No, so we are not doing any tissue biopsies in this particular study, but we are doing...
So not a horribly invasive study for the volunteers.
Exactly. Exactly. It's already a little bit difficult to get to. Enrollment has been a little bit slower than we had hoped. How about that? And we knew that that would be a concern, right? That these patients had been told for years and years and years that they don't need treatment, ever. Mm-hmm. And to try to change their thinking a little bit, or to at least to make them aware that therapy might be beneficial, takes some education and some convincing, right?
Well, yeah, and not only that, you clearly are an empathetic human, and it is not unrealistic to think that people, not everybody, is going to be like Tim Brown and be willing to be poked and prodded, you know, to the ends of the earth. So it's understandable.
Absolutely. I completely agree. But there are, you know, pretty much we are going to be doing everything we can with the blood, you know, in terms of looking at all markers of cellular T-cell kind of activation, various cells, cellular activation, markers of systemic inflammation. We're going to try to look through all these different cell populations to see where HIV might be hiding and whether or not it'll enhance the regeneration of T-cells, the use of antiretroviral therapy. We'll be looking at quality of life in patients as well. And,
can you be more specific about what you mean by quality of life?
Yeah, I think patients are getting a questionnaire to see whether the effects, you know, sometimes, you know, for our non-controllers, at least, sometimes when they take treatment, there will be some side effects associated with that. And that's part of what we're trying to figure out, whether how that affects, the side effects affect them. But also, some of my patients, at least, feel better on treatment. You know, it's not that necessarily they weren't feeling, you know, that they had this baseline of health that they were used to, that they didn't realize was necessarily abnormal, but that on treatment, these patients actually felt, you know, to have a little bit more energy, to feel a little bit better. And so we want to look at how difficult is it for these patients to take because of, are there any side effects that are really affecting their life? And also whether taking these medications might somehow give them a little bit more energy or are they not having any problems with these medications. So.
Good. How are you guys going to be measuring adherence?
So during the initial part of the study, there's a viral decay component of the study for a subset of patients. But for those patients, they'll be getting kind of an adherence journal to be taken home to kind of fill out what time of day that they're taking the medications. Otherwise, when they're coming in for their visits, there's kind of a questionnaire that to ask them about adherence.
Okay. But no, like, intensive pill bottle?
No.
Or,
okay. No. Yeah. No.
Why 57? What makes 57 a magic number?
It's a balance. It's a balance between the numbers that we think that we can realistically enroll, as well as a statistical analysis of what makes sense in terms of powering the study for being able to see a difference
gotcha.
In the T-cell activation. So it's a balance.
I think you've answered all of my questions, and then some. Is there anything I'm missing that you wanted to say about the study that we haven't discussed yet?
So I think we covered a lot of ground.
All right. Thanks
a lot,
time,
Miles.
John.
I appreciate it.